time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Kristen Bifus. Kristen Bifus is Executive Director of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition, and we're going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Kristen, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having us, Mike, and covering this important issue.
So start out, tell us a bit about the Washington Fair Trade Coalition.
The Washington Fair Trade Coalition is based here in Washington State and made up of 66 labor, social justice, environmental, faith, family farm, fair trade businesses, and student organizations working for an equitable global trading policy. And we're connected nationally with Citizens Trade Campaign, so other state affiliates, and Public Citizen.
Great. And when did your organization come about?
We've been around officially as an organization for about 7 years, but we really came out of the people's shutdown of the WTO in 99. And even prior to that, ad hocly groups were getting together to fight against NAFTA, to organize around the WTO, and then to fight against CAFTA. And then there was a recognition these free trade agreements keep coming with the same broken model, and that we need to have a dedicated organization here in Washington State that's tracking, educating folks, as well as advocating for what we want to see in trade agreements, which is, you know, workers' rights, human rights, environmental protections, all the things that our communities value here in Washington State.
Very good. So tell us about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What is that?
Sure. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a free trade agreement. It started back in the Bush administration and was put on hold when Obama first came into office. And then he picked it up after the first year of his administration. And so it's been an active negotiation for the past 4 years now. It involves 12 countries. Initially, it involved 9, but in the last couple of years, other countries have joined. It is Pacific Rim, and so the countries it involves are Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Peru, Chile, Australia, New Zealand, Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan. And it actually has a clause in it that allows other countries to join. And so any country that's a Pacific Rim country, either during the negotiations or even after the negotiations have been concluded, could potentially join on to this agreement, which makes it very unusual. Our other trade agreements, such as NAFTA and CAFTA, are bound. No other countries can join on. And it has been probably one of the most secretive trade negotiations that we've seen. And so to be able to tell your listeners the content, we have relied mostly on leaked texts. Because these negotiations have happened behind closed doors. From what we understand, there are 29 chapters. We're not even given the titles of all the chapters. Though when we think about trade agreements, it's the flow of goods and services and wanting to enable there to be a more easy flow of goods and services. And while a couple of the chapters do focus on the elimination of tariffs so that corporations can have access to markets, the majority are around rewriting global laws and extending intellectual property rights, enabling corporations to have even more global rights. Actually, the folks that have unlimited access to the text, there are about 600 corporations that have access to the text and are involved actively in negotiations. And they're the ones that you might imagine, the Walmarts, the Cargills, the Monsantos, the big banks, and it's being negotiated within the executive branch. So USTR, which is the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, are the chief negotiators. And actually, many of the negotiators come from the corporate world. And so we're seeing corporations at the table, both representing the interests of the U.S. as well as corporations as their own global entities being at the table. Actually, in our minds, privatizing public policy.
So in addition to the executive branch, are there any other government representatives in there that one has access to?
Well, actually, under the U.S. Constitution, Congress has the rights and the responsibilities of regulating foreign commerce. And so we had been reaching out to our elected officials because the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for it to be complete, has to be voted on by Congress. And we have been reaching out to our elected officials to ask to get the text because they have much more power than we do. We elect them into office. And just recently, they have the USTR has made it easier for members of Congress to access the text. It's been very difficult. There were all sorts of parameters put on Congress. They had to, be in a certain room, and they couldn't release it to their staffers. All sorts of parameters that made it very hard for very busy lawmakers to be able to access what's really been going on. However, what USTR has asked for is for Congress to give them the power to complete these negotiations by giving them fast track authority. And basically what fast track authority means is they give their constitutional power over to the executive branch. And as we know, we've only elected one person into the executive branch, and that's President Obama, where we have all of our elected officials in Congress that we have voted to represent us. And so we have been reaching out to our Congress members here in Washington State saying, we want you to pledge to vote no on fast track and keep your authority until you've seen the text, because many of them haven't seen the text, so they don't even know what they are voting on. And so we say, keep your authority, see the text, and negotiate, talk about what needs to be in these texts on behalf of workers, what kinds of environmental protections need to be in there, how will this benefit our community? And if you can tell us definitively that this will benefit the majority of people in Washington State and not just the corporate interests, then support it. But until you absolutely know that, you cannot give away your authority.
So has the executive branch, are they currently trying to seek fast-track authority from Congress?
They are. They actively are. And that's why there actually has been some members of Congress that have been reaching out, and particularly Representative McDermott here in Washington State has provided a lot of leadership in saying he will not support fast-track, and right now he will not support the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And is that a majority vote that would allow Congress to give the president fast track authority?
It is, yeah. And what fast track authority would mean is that when the TPP comes up for a vote, Congress would only be able to vote yes or no. And just to give people a picture, we had fast track authority. Fast track authority gave us NAFTA, and fast track authority gave us CAFTA. And after 20 years of NAFTA, seeing the loss of jobs and the promises really unfulfilled. Because back 20 years ago, we were promised a lot. And similarly, we're promised a lot with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It will be job creating. It will help stabilize economies around the world. It will promote high labor standards. It will promote high environmental standards. And 20 years of evidence has shown that that has actually not been the case. And so we really want to be able to look at each of these chapters and have Congress to be able to influence them in the process. Because what we've realized also with free trade agreements is that the power we have is in the negotiating process. Once they've been put into effect, we have really very little power to amend them or change them in any way, despite promises. You might remember back on the campaign trail in 2008, candidate Obama and candidate Clinton were talking about how NAFTA has failed us, right? Right in Detroit, talking about the loss of automotive jobs and saying we need to renegotiate this. And we're seeing the TPP as this backdoor renegotiation. At the end of last year, Canada and Mexico joined. So really making this the supersized version of NAFTA, NAFTA plus 9 countries. And what we're seeing is not a renegotiation, not a 21st century trade agreement, but actually a lot of the same old stuff that's extending the rights of corporate personhood. Because under our trade agreements, under NAFTA and under CAFTA, there's a chapter that elevates corporations to be equal to countries. And so if they don't like the rules of a country, if they don't like the labor standards, the environmental standards, they can actually sue that country to change those labor standards. And we have been seeing over the course of NAFTA, the 20 years, corporations getting bolder and bolder in how they are using NAFTA to really fight the hard-fought regulations that communities are working on right now, communities here in Washington State. There's a recent egregious example of communities in Quebec that worked very hard to put a pause on fracking because they wanted to study the impacts of fracking to their water sources. And there's a company, and originally the company seems to hail from the U.S. It's called Lone Pines, and it has a headquarters in Delaware. But if you look a little closer, the company actually is out of Alberta. So this is a Canadian company that is using NAFTA to sue their own country because they want to change a law that a community has put in place. Not even a law, actually, just a moratorium. And so we are very concerned that people here are working on, you know, labeling of GMO foods. I mean, that's an issue that we're going to be voting on in November, or looking at issues of climate change and how to put legislation in place. And one of the concerns is that our trade agreements can erode those hard-fought victories in other sectors. And so the trade agreements very much dig deep. And I'm just talking about what's happening here in North America. And there's been huge resistance throughout North America, throughout South America, but also throughout Asia, Australia, and New Zealand.
So this also sounds very similar to structures that the WTO brought us, World Trade Organization. Is that true?
Yeah, very, very similar. And in fact, because of the people's shutdown in 99, what we had been seeing up until now are these smaller kind of bilateral trade agreements, because the WTO round in Seattle was never able to conclude. And it was an example of corporations overreaching, of trying to bring together many countries and getting them to agree to standards around you know, the rights of big agri, the rights of pharmaceutical companies. And so they kind of circled around and realized, well, actually, we're not going to be able to do this in one fell swoop. And so we're going to create these bilateral trade agreements. And we've seen them with Colombia. We've seen them with Panama. We've seen them with South Korea. And this is another attempt to be able to create an umbrella set of rules and regulations that are codified by corporations, and that a number of different countries are going to have to abide by them. And it's making countries open up their markets even further to corporate interests. And that's where we see resistance, right? We're seeing resistance in Malaysia. Public health organizations in Malaysia are taking to the streets because of pharmaceutical companies' interest in extending patents. And so in Asia right now, because of the epidemic of HIV/AIDS, I, for a number of years, actually lived in Thailand during the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and Thailand started producing its own antiretrovirals, generic antiretrovirals that people who are living on a couple dollars a day could actually afford, that public health systems could actually provide for their people. And we're looking at seeing an erosion of those global health advancements. And so activists in Malaysia have been taking to the streets. There was just a TPP round of negotiations in Malaysia in July, and people were arrested because this is literally people's lives. And what we're seeing, and why actually Representative McDermott has been so important in this struggle, is that communities in Africa rely on the generic medicines, the generic antiretrovirals that are being produced in Asia. And I know myself and many people here in this country rely on generic medicines. It's what a lot of health insurance plans are able to support. And so while we think research and innovation and development is very important, we also feel that pharmaceutical companies are making enough money and making enough profits on the patented drugs, and that they are using this as an opportunity to extend their patents, to change their formulations a little bit and create a whole new patent, and that this is actually going to impact global health. And we've seen groups like Medecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, have said that they rely on generic medicines to be able to do the global relief and health work that they do, and that these are taxpayer dollars that go into these global health programs that will just not be able to go as far if pharmaceutical companies have their way. And again, they're using the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the fact that majority of people don't know what's happening. As we're talking to people, when people hear about what's going on, just similarly with the WTO, similarly with NAFTA, when you poll people on whether NAFTA has been good for the U.S., 3/4 of people say no. It's been bad for the economy. It's been bad for the creation of jobs. It's only created poverty wage jobs, and we've lost living wage, family wage jobs. And so that's our big effort, is to let people know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership so that they can be reaching out to their elected officials and saying, this doesn't represent us, because it will really impact us. It will impact us as eaters around what's in our food and labeling requirements. It'll impact us as workers. It will only extend the Walmartization that we've been facing, the creation of poverty wage jobs where people are working full time and are still relying on government assistance programs because they can't support their family on minimum wage jobs. It'll support us. It will impact us as members of community that value healthy community. We fought for water safety standards and standards for our air and what pollutants are allowed into our communities. And it will also impact us as people, because corporations are getting more and more rights and people are getting less and less rights on this planet.
Yeah, you previously mentioned both Clinton and Obama talking about the devastation to Detroit, and that was prior to Detroit declaring bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
You were sticking with the example you were just talking about with generics and other countries relying on those. So the TPP would, in fact, from what we know, would allow these pharmaceutical companies to extend their patents in 20-year leaps. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Or as we talked about, being able to repatent things by just sort of changing the a small formula in the drug. Also, for countries like Canada and New Zealand and Australia that have a government-supported health system, they rely on being able to negotiate tough negotiations with pharmaceutical companies. And so pharmaceutical companies are looking at this as an opportunity. And I should say also Japan. Japan coming in, there was huge resistance to Japan coming in, a small rally in Japan is 6,000 people. And so they have had people on the streets. And in addition to concern around farming commodities, one of the other concerns is around the government-supported health system in Japan. They have an incredible system where the average Japanese person has access to really cutting-edge medicines, and why many communities, people in the region, go to Japan for healthcare, because it's quite extraordinary. And so there's a concern that governments will be absolutely depleted and they won't be able to provide the same if they're needing to provide these very expensive drugs to their communities. They will be providing less of it, and it will really erode really these bipartisan systems, because in these countries it's not political, right? Healthcare is not political in a political issue. It is seen as a human rights issue in those communities. And so pharmaceutical companies have been looking for ways to get into these countries. And also to say on the other health side, Philip Morris has been looking for ways to fight labeling. And New Zealand and Australia have very aggressive labeling on their cigarette packages. And they're using this as a way to say, this is a barrier to trade, because, right, it all comes down to, this is a barrier to trade. And if you are impacting our profits, corporate America or global corporations, they're based in America, but they're not actually our corporations. But if you're impacting our profits, you don't get to do that, even if our product has been proven to be harmful to your public. And so it is really just turning common sense on its ear of what we as communities get to advocate for and what countries get to advocate for. And so that's why we feel that we need to have huge public opinion being put forward on this to say, no, I care about the health of my community, and I don't want to see it eroded on the backs. I don't want profits being on the backs of my community.
And my understanding is, and when these corporations sue, when they want one of these laws changed and the law, the country sticks to their guns, so to speak, the corporation sues for perceived or potential profits, not even actual damages. This is what we could have made had we sold these cigarettes to your children, and now you have to give us X number of millions of dollars in return.
Yeah, there was a recent case that just settled, and I should say, kind of clarify, the courts we're talking about are not domestic courts. They're not the courts that you and I have access to. They're actually these arbitration tribunals, and they're being overseen by the World Bank. And what happens is there are three arbitrators, and these are not judges. These are attorneys. And sometimes they represent the country, and sometimes they represent the corporation. So they go back and forth. This is their profession. And the country gets to pick one, the corporation gets to pick one, and they mutually decide on another. And there's no parameters of what they can decide. They can compel the country to change their law. And as you say, they can assess any amount of damage that they want. And so there was a recent case of Cargill suing the country of Mexico because Mexico put a very high tariff on high fructose corn syrup, which we know has been proven to be a public health devastation. Also, Mexico trying to protect their corn industry, right? Mexico, the birthplace of corn. And they've been seeing erosion of that industry by dumping from corporations like Cargill and Monsanto. So Cargill sued them under NAFTA and said, your tariff is a barrier to trade. You need to reduce this tariff. And Cargill won. And they were awarded $95 million. So Mexico has to pay $95 million to Cargill. And this is despite the huge profits that Cargill has reaped in the 20 years of NAFTA in Mexico. And so we're seeing, as I said, bolder and bolder cases. There was another case of a Canadian mining corporation, Pacific Rim. So it's a Canadian corporation, and they were in El Salvador, and they were doing some testing. We all know Central America, very rich in minerals, gold. And so they found gold deposits in El Salvador, using very, very invasive drilling techniques where they had to infuse water at very high pressure, using huge amounts of water from the main watershed in El Salvador, and leaving behind a wake of chemicals, selenium, arsenic, all sorts of things you do not want in your water source. And through enormous pressure and life loss in El Salvador, the government said, actually, we're revoking your permits. So you don't actually get to be doing any more mining. And so this is a Canadian company. And so they created a subsidiary in the U.S. to be able to sue the country of El Salvador under CAFTA. And even though there's a C in CAFTA, that doesn't stand for Canada. It stands for Central America. So Canada is not even part of this trade agreement, but they created a subsidiary so they could sue. And they sued them not only for their initial investment, but they sued them for potential profits. So it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And thank goodness that lawsuit was actually thrown out. But Pacific Rim is not stopping. They're looking for other ways to be able to get in there to take out gold. And so they can sell it for their own profits, not benefiting the people of El Salvador at all. And for people who know the history of El Salvador, know El Salvador is, been struggling to create stable community after many, many years of armed conflict. And so they don't have resources to be able to pay companies for loss of their potential profits. It's just absolutely ridiculous and goes against the things we value.
And in that particular instance, it would be the government and the people of El Salvador mm-hmm. that were paying just for the legal fees to try and keep this company out.
Absolutely. And so that's the situation that it's the taxpayers that are paying because, for example, with the suit, the fracking suit, it's Quebec that has the moratorium, but the company sues Canada. And so the country has to decide whether they're going to take on that suit. And as you said, it's very expensive. They have to use taxpayer dollars. It's millions of dollars. And they may win, they may not win. And so what might happen is, you know, the Canadian government right now under Harper might, very pro-extraction, might turn to Quebec and say, well, we're not going to engage in this fight and you need to lift your moratorium.
Only a few minutes left. Mm-hmm. So since environment plays such a key in this, one could perceive that with the current push towards restricting the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere here in in Washington state with against the coal trains, things like that, that this agreement would see that as a restriction on trade and could potentially stop any laws that were enacted with that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. In the conversations around, carbon tax and different creative solutions, absolutely, this could be seen as a barrier to trade. And as we've been talking with, 350.org and Bill McKibben's coming out here and very much have been working with environmentalists like the Sierra Club to recognize that we need to be jointly working on trade because our trade agreements can really reach down into so many environmental and social justice regulations and challenge them. And we're seeing it, around fracking. And what's driving the fracking industry? Well, it's the cost of natural gas. And it's really looking at, they say follow the money. And it's looking at, well, the cost of natural gas, the prices of natural gas are incredibly high in Southeast Asia and Japan. And so that's the market that fracking corporations want to have access to. Natural gas isn't such a hot commodity here. It's not, I think the cost is, a few dollars here, where in Japan it's, five times that. And so a lot, again, it's really challenging. We need trade agreements because we need jobs, but we really need to challenge what are the quality of those jobs. And we talk about the need for fracking in these extractive industries because we need to be energy independent. But really, is it about energy independence or is it really about profits for energy companies globally? And really challenging these promises. We have 20 years of evidence of NAFTA, of a lot of promises that, well, not only were they not fulfilled, but they just were untrue. And so really challenging listeners that when they're hearing these sound bites about why we need to be doing these things, really need to question who's saying these things. And really points to the amount of corporate dollars in our political system. And so when we're hearing our elected leaders saying these are the things we need to look at who's backing those leaders and that it is really corporate interests that they're contributing to political campaigns. They're writing our trade agreements. They're the ones that are pushing down standards and that we really need to be questioning that in our communities and reminding our elected leaders that ultimately we are electing them and we can choose not to elect them and they are not doing their jobs if they don't represent us, if they are representing the corporations.
So how can people find out more about this issue?
So encourage people to go to our website, washingtonfairtrade.org. Something I didn't mention, another website is TPPXBorder. So it's TPP, just the letter X, border.org. And this is a group of activists in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico that are linking the different issues throughout the continent. And on there, there's a tri-national unity letter. Encourage folks to reach out to their elected officials on Fast Track because that will be coming up in the next month. And so just simply telling our elected officials to pledge no, to vote no on Fast Track. But that's all on our website, and they can take a look at that. And also be reaching out to local media outlets. We really do appreciate KEXP covering it today. And that's been one of the big struggles, is getting mainstream media to cover this issue. Because we feel very confident when people know what's going on, there'll be outrage. There'll be people in the streets, and it's starting to happen. We just want to make sure it happens before this trade agreement is finalized.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Again, we have just been talking with Kristen Bifus. She is executive director of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition, and you can find out more about their organization at their website, washingtonfairtrade.org.